last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
You're very welcome back to The Last Word. Danny McConnell sitting in for Matt Cooper. Now, I'm delighted to say I'm joined in studio by multi-award-winning author Donal Ryan, who is here with me to discuss his latest novel, Where Are the Kings? The book is the story of 12-year-old Jack, whose world is turned upside down following the tragic death of his mother and the departure of his father, leaving him to be cared by his grandparents. Donal Ryan, thank you very much for joining us here on The Last Word.
Thanks, Danny. Great to be here.
I hope I did the book justice there in the intro. But through all of you, I've read, I think, pretty much every one of the books that you've written, and you have this amazing ability to describe the ordinary in very extraordinary terms. And I wondered, from your decision to go with a book like this and to tell it from the perspective of a 12-year-old, I mean, that probably presented a great opportunity for you as a storyteller. But did you have any even trepidations going into a book like this?
I did. I had a few false starts now, I must say, all right, because I found it a bit of a struggle at the start to find a voice, the proper voice. And then I realised the best thing to do is to be authentic, you know, to be myself if I can. No, I was pretty thick as a 12-year-old. I've given Jack a lot more acuity and intelligence than I had, you know, and he sees the world more clearly. But he is also burdened by this huge, monstrous weight of grief that I didn't have at that age. Yeah. So I tried to imagine myself having that situation in my life and how I might have acted and how that might have acted on me. And so it was very interesting, you know, because it describes 2 years of Jack's life pretty much. And the third section describes, you know, one day in his life. But I really enjoyed it, you know. Yeah. I mean, I stayed very close to home. I mean, part of the book takes place in Frankie Boland's arcade in Nina, where I spent half my teenage years, you know, and I kept all my old friends' names in the book, and I made sure it was very real.
I was going to say, like, the way you write, you almost get the smells, the sounds, the sights from the page. I mean, you were there, and I think that's a great gift. As someone who's written kind of non-fiction, that's all very fact-driven and it's research. With this, your heavy lifting is done up here in the brain before you even put pen to paper, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, in fairness, non-fiction, you have to get it right. And I don't. It's a thing, you know. I mean, we have this freedom of this thing called verisimilitude as fiction writers, the act of making it seem right.
Yeah.
You know, so if I close my eyes and try to remember, what was Frankie's like inside? How did it smell? You know, it'll just come back to me and I'll kind of get it and I can write an impression of what I remember. And fiction also is guesswork a lot of the time. You know, you're trying to imagine what it's like to be somebody else, and so you're stretching your empathy and you're never sure you have it right. And you'll never get it right because you'll never perfectly articulate in words what it is to be alive. So every story is an attempt at it. Every novel, every piece of art, it's all a failure. You can never actually do it. So we keep trying. And so I'm kind of unburdened from the shackles of being correct and being completely right all the time.
You talk of, you know, writing Jack as a 12-year-old, but almost with this, like, you know, with your experience as an adult. I mean, just walk me through that process. Because again, as you say, when you're a 12-year-old, you're sort of an unreliable kind of reference of your own story, really, aren't you?
I mean, in lots of ways, Jack is a very unreliable narrator. And so I use the kind of free indirect style where it's not quite first person, but it's very close to Jack's consciousness all the time. But I'm still free to depart from it. So I can kind of wind things into the story that Jack doesn't know, but the reader will know. Yeah. So there are lots of things in the story that are very obvious to the reader before Jack finds out, or before Jack even admits to himself this is the case. Like there's a series of revelations at the end that Jack kind of half knew all along.
Yeah.
But the confrontation of these things kind of causes him to have a bit of a breakdown.
But there's also, I think, throughout this book, and I think some of your other books, is it's that ability to, you know, particularly for, say, Jack, who is a 12-year-old, and that thing that we all remember as kids, things that in reality are very small, but they were absolutely massive and crucial.
Completely, Danny, absolutely. Yeah, I remember things like particular books and objects in the kitchen and a tea tray my mum had with a picture of a woman and two kids walking through a forest on it that I just thought was the most important thing in the kitchen. And the kitchen was our whole world, so therefore was the most important object in the world, you know?
Yeah.
Because I thought, that's me and Mary and Mam in the picture, you know? It's amazing. And I still think back about the thing. I still feel this lovely warmth and comfort when I think about it. It's amazing. You know, but I remember that a teacher in school, Martin Slattery, talking about Patrick Kavanagh's depiction of the steely, greeny waters of the Grand Canal, you know, and how he goes, look, lads, it's a bit of a weed inside in the canal. Look how beautiful he makes it. Look how momentous and how important he makes it seem, you know, and that was a very profound moment.
When you approach, say, a book like this, and there's some heavy themes in this book, and there's some heavy kind of, like, it's weighty enough stuff, but yet there's great pinches of humour and kind of, I won't say farce. Farce is probably the wrong word, but like, I mean, even Nana in at the start, where she calls someone a dopey prick, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's a brilliant.
Oh, turn. It's adamant.
Yeah. It's a brilliant phrase, but again, it just punctures the, or sort of just injects a kind of a bit of levity into. And I think the Irish are very good at finding humour in dark places.
Yeah, I mean, we're really good at lots of things, but that's one of the things we're best at. I think, you know, is just making light of things and getting through things with humour and using language in a way that just lightens things and that can actually express things that can't be said. You know, there's a very interstitial nature to the way we use profanity in Ireland. It's utilitarian in a way. We use it to say certain things that we can't really say, to express things we can't express, because, you know, so much is inarticulable. Language is so limited. And you can use all sorts of complex language and highfalutin words and notions, but a few F's and C words here and there can express things that can't be articulated. Yeah. So, you know, it's amazing.
And talk to me about writing about relationships, and particularly in a family dynamic. I mean, because that's obviously a big challenge, because it's we've heard of a lot of novels are, you know, based around a family and all that kind of stuff, but to do it well must be incredibly difficult. And how critical are you of yourself, I suppose, in getting that right?
I think... the best thing for writers, I think, is in the first draft, don't think about it. Mm. Don't think about how hard it could
be. Just get it out.
Get it out, yeah. And see how the family looks or how the characters look on the page and how they sound. And then in your second and third draft, start to think about what you might be able to improve and what's wrong in the first draft. But I think your instinctive creative process is the best and the truest. Mm. You know, what goes down on impulse onto the page.
And how much of the finalised novel would you do in your first draft? I mean, are you doing a couple of chapters? Do you do the whole lot? Or how much would you do in your first draft?
I always misremember this. I always think back, I always think, oh God, I nearly did it the first time around. You know, the first draft is nearly the last draft. But if I look back then at my drafts, my successive drafts in my folder, they'll be very different. You know, sometimes they're never quite fundamentally changed, because I generally have the backbone of a story worked out before I start to write. I have the ending worked out and I have the means of arriving at the ending worked out, but I will have grievous faults in the first few drafts, you know, things that just won't work for a reader. They'll work for me as a writer. I think it's great.
Yeah.
You know, but then when you have the cold objective eye of your, you know, your spouse or your editor looking at it, like Anne-Marie's great as a first reader. She's so instinctive. And my editor, Brian Langan, is brilliant, you know, and he will make notes and read it and go, No, I totally disagree. And then, you know, an hour later, I read it again and go, oh God, he's completely right. How did I not see that?
And that, I always wonder, like, this is coming from you. This is your art.
Yeah.
And then to have to hand it over to somebody else to kick lumps out of it, essentially, and critique it and knock the edges off. I mean, how does that process sit with you? Because I know for some authors, it's the most painful thing in the world.
It can be traumatic, all right. I have to say that now. And I think this is one of the great things about things like... I know, not just to plug the MA in UL, but our creative writing MA in UL. When you do an MA, you hand your work over on a weekly basis to people who at the start are strangers.
Mm.
And they will critique it and analyse it, deconstruct it, make notes on it, suggest revisions, you know. And I can see it, the effect it can have on people.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be debilitating, but it's nearly always worth it going through it, you know, having it broken down.
We even see it with young reporters in our newsroom, is almost breaking them down to build them back up again.
Exactly.
With the fundamentals of writing.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, this is not your first novel or your second. It's probably your eighth or ninth. Ninth at this stage. How confident are you now as a writer in your own writing, or do you still have that nerve wracking sort of self or bouts of self doubt, or where do you sit with that?
It's funny how it seems to change book by book. I remember writing the first draft of The Queen of Dirt Island, and I was writing really early in the mornings, and so I'd write for about 3 hours, and then I spent 3 hours absolutely detesting and hating what I'd written, and thinking I'm going to give this up. I can't do it.
Mm.
Pure fraud. And then leaving it for a while, going back that evening to look at it again and going, actually, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's so strange. And I had this really up and down relationship with confidence for that whole novel. Sometimes I'll write a whole novel straight through and on this kind of huge cresting wave of confidence. And that might break completely at the end and I realise it didn't work at all, you know.
Yeah.
So it changes. For this novel, I was fine all the way through. I kind of knew I had a very good handle on what had to happen.
Yeah.
How I was going to get where I was going to get. And Theo and Holly in particular gave me a great handout. Like, they came alive, you know.
They're very interesting characters in this book. And
yeah.
They're useful to keep the story moving or to kind of move it along or...
Absolutely, yeah.
You know.
Oh, they were so useful. I mean, and sometimes a character in a book can be profound and spiritual and complex. And sometimes it can be those things and really useful as objects in your story, you know, as things that you can build a story around. You know, when you need something to happen, they can make it happen.
Yeah.
They can just be the person who picks the thing up and puts it down or takes the shot or says the word. It's brilliant.
Are you ever, or do you ever come across, or have you ever had the experience that the idea was brilliant in your head before you start mapping it out, but yet the execution of it didn't end up? I mean, how does that sit with, or how do you manage deal with that? Like,
this happened to me during COVID. I wrote a big, long, dark, complex novel during COVID. And I genuinely thought now, because Emery was ill during COVID, and she was in treatment for cancer. And so she said, you know what? This is your seventh book now, right? You don't need me. Yeah. The first draft. Write it. And then when I'm feeling better at the end of the process, you know, I'll be out of treatment, I'll read the whole thing back. And I said, that's great. You will do that. And for the whole writing of it, I was going, oh my God, this is the best ever. Jesus, I'm a genius. And if you're thinking that, you're in trouble, you know.
You're in trouble, yeah.
Yeah. So I got to the end of it and reread it. And she went, oh yeah, I'm not really sure, you know. And I really, straight away I realised, this is terrible. You know, this is not publishable.
Overindulgent, or did you just think
it was kind of
yeah. over the...
I was trying to do too much. I was pushing too many boundaries. I was being very experimental, and I was taking a lot of risks narratively. It was very dark. Now, I know it can be saved if I had the time to do it. Maybe I will someday, but you know, at the time I thought, line by line, it was perfect. This is coming out exactly the way I want it. This is beautiful.
And from your perspective, are there any no-go areas as a writer for you? That are there certain topics or areas, or like some writers in novels just won't touch politics or contemporary politics? Others, are there any no-go areas for you, or do you just think... You can't inhibit yourself if you're starting out.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I tended to steer away very dramatically from graphic descriptions of the sexual act, because like, no one needs to be me to be telling them how it works. You know, it's fine, so I don't do it. So I will allude to it, and you know.
But the illusion almost is better, like, you know.
I think so. Yeah, you can get in very bad trouble very quickly doing that. But I do think we have an obligation as writers of fiction to represent life. And what we think we know of life, or what we're trying to understand of life, and try to make something feel real, true language for other people. Yeah. So I don't think we can apply those restrictions to ourselves about subject matters.
And just back to this book, Where the Kings, was there a deliberate decision to kind of pitch it in the 1990s as opposed to modern day?
Thinking back now, I think it's because I thought to myself, if I'm to give my most faithful description of a teenager in Ireland, it'll have to be set roughly when I was a teenager.
Okay.
You know, so now it's set mainly in 97, 98. I was a bit older than that at the time, but still the 90s, I suppose, for me was my teenage years.
Yeah.
And so that was where I thought I could get the most authenticity from.
And it's a pre-mobile phone era, and that probably
as well, actually.
Yeah.
They can be problematic. They can cause big problems for stories.
Yeah.
Mobile phones.
Well, listen, we've just handed a mobile phone to my teenage girl, Eliza. She's just turned 13.
Really?
And the change, she won't like me here, but like, it's amazing.
I know exactly what you mean. Absolutely.
So for you, like, does there ever come the day where you just think, I'm not going to do anything else, but writing novels is going to be the only thing that you could ever do? Or
that'd be great. Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen, though, to be honest. I think... But now, in fairness, I remember Joe O'Connor saying a few years ago, no writer should be just a writer.
And okay.
He's right, to be honest.
Yeah.
So no, it's fairly isolating.
How do you, in your head, like then separate your day job from doing this? You know, I mean, how do you manage this sort of, because I would have thought, given how you do this, it's a very intensive process.
Yeah.
And I just don't see how you could do that. Say, all right, from 9 to 5, I'm in the day job and then I'm going to go off and do this. Or how do you manage to do it?
Well, two of my dear friends and colleagues at UL, Owen Devereaux and Sarah Moore, talk to students about this all the time, and making a certain part of your day or your week sacred for writing, and being really strict about it with yourself and with your family and friends, you know, and saying, no, that's the time I have to write. You know, whether it's an hour a day or half an hour a day, or, you know, half day on Saturdays or whatever it is, have that time and carve it
dedicated
out.
Time.
And work your schedule around it and make sure it's kept sacred.
And are you better in the morning or in the evenings?
In the morning, definitely.
In the mornings, yeah. Because I know some people who can work very late at night. I'm just not one of those people. So you're actually at the Pembroke Canister Church this evening?
I am.
That's a reading of the book, is it?
He is, yeah. Alex Clark, actually. Alex is a fabulous journalist and broadcaster and writer herself, interviewer, and I love being on stage with her, so hopefully it'll be a good evening.
Well, listen, there are, I understand, a couple of tickets left available for that, so if you want to pop down to see Donal Ryan. But it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you here on The Last Word, and I wish you all the very best with the book.
Thanks so much, Danny.
The book is called Where Are the Kings, and it's out now, I presume?
It is from today, yeah.
Out from today, so Donal Ryan, go to Mila Margaret.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.